Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Nicholas. Yourself?
Not too bad, not too bad. I went to bed a little late, but otherwise I'm all good. And I'm also joined today by Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys? Ready for the weekend?
Indeed, very much ready for the weekend and the short week next week. Let's get into the news of today. And the first one is Wednesday's by-elections, which saw the IFP continuing its pretty strong winning streak across KZN. The IFP won three wards in the Newcastle municipality. Now, the good news is, I think in at least two of those wards, the councillor was not murdered. In fact, I think the councillor was not murdered in any of them.
All three of them, the guys, yeah. Nobody was murdered in any of the three.
Yeah, one died, and then two ANC councillors resigned. This is very good news for KZN because, unfortunately, these days that seems to be an increasingly rare occurrence that a councillor leaves the job by natural means. But anyway, the IFP's vote in these three wards, which all were previously won by the ANC, was pretty impressive. 61% in the one, 59% in the other, and then another 64% in the final one. So big swing in their favor, solid majorities in all of them, and now the IFP has gone from being the second largest party in the Newcastle municipality to being the largest. Newcastle municipality has been governed by the IFP in coalition with the DA, Team Sugar, which is a local party, and Action SA and the Freedom Front Plus. But this victory now makes them definitively the biggest party taking over from the ANC. So it does seem that the ANC continues to be in very big trouble in KZN, and not just to the MK party. Although the MK party, and this is, I think, quite interesting, didn't stand in these by-elections. Now, you know, maybe they just couldn't organize it in time, or maybe there was some other issue that didn't do it. But it would have been interesting to see how MK performed in these by-elections, what effect they had on the vote, whether they would have taken more from the ANC or the IFP. Marius, what do you make of these results?
I think it's pretty interesting. In all three of the by-elections, or in all three of the wards, in the 2021 local government elections, the IFP had got between, say, 15 and 20% in all three of those wards. But now on Wednesday, as you said, they got over 50% in each of the wards and won each of them pretty comfortably. And the EFF went backwards in all of those wards. So it seems that people are in KwaZulu-Natal turning away from the EFF. And the EFF has generally, especially in urban areas, been doing pretty well in KwaZulu-Natal over the last couple of years and by-elections and stuff. And Newcastle, I think, is the third biggest city in KwaZulu-Natal. So it's pretty telling that the EFF did pretty badly there. It went from, say, 15 to 20% in most of these wards down to about 5%. And, you know, the IFP really gave them, really whacked them in these elections. So, I think the EFF is in pretty big trouble in KwaZulu-Natal. And I think it's not impossible. It could be the fifth biggest party in the province after the elections. Our colleague Sihle Ngobesi, aka Big Daddy Liberty, says the EFF apparently fired their main organizer in KwaZulu-Natal, a guy called, I think it's Vusi Khoza. And apparently he was a very sharp guy, very well organized, and he was a large part of the reason for the success of the EFF. But he apparently didn't, he was one of the guys fired because he didn't organize enough buses to go to that big rally the EFF had a little while ago. I think it was for their birthday or whatever it was, at FNB. And apparently he got the boot. And yeah, so now that's resulting in what's happening with the EFF. They seem to be in a bit of a dwang in KwaZulu-Natal.
Yeah, you see, this is why you can't run an organization like a, you know, sort of cult-like Spaz dictatorship. Inevitably, you're going to completely drive out talent and, you know, mistreat people, and all you're going to get is kind of incompetent yes men following you. So I think Malema is really shooting himself in the foot by being so brutal on his own team members. Team Sugar, which came, I think, third or fourth in all of these by-elections, beating the EFF. It's quite interesting because actually it's originally a breakaway from the EFF, but it's in coalition with the IFP. and the other NPC parties. Terence, what do you make of this? At the same time, we've also had Nomvula Mokonyane from the ANC saying that coalitions won't work for us, and we haven't had time to turn around the country. You know, with this unemployment, this inequality stuff has been so stubborn. 30 years isn't enough to get rid of it. We might only consider a coalition partner who is willing to get on board with the task at hand. And there is some speculation that the IFP might not be as warm and committed to the multi-party charter as and that they might form a coalition with the ANC. Do you think that that's at all possible? And what's your take on these by-election results?
Well, I suppose first of all, some disclaimer. I spent a fair part of my younger life in Newcastle, so I know it well and has many happy memories and some not so happy and some very woozy. But I'm reliably assured, I'm reliably informed that I was there. Like I said, I mentioned that was my younger days. I what sort of occurs to me immediately is that, in the early 90s, that sort of northern Natal area was viewed as very strong in Carter territory. But the ANC, because of the manufacturing, the trade unions, and so on, it had established a very strong presence in Newcastle. So there's, I don't know, call it a certain symmetry in the fact that as the ANC finds itself in trouble, it seems to be taking taking hits from the IFP. The sort of macro story, I suppose, is that the reports of the IFP's death have been somewhat exaggerated. And I think there's also something to be said for the fact that the IFP is probably the least understood of South Africa's political presences. I think a lot of people looking in from the outside have either come at it with, from a romanticized perspective, or from a from beg your pardon, from a an ideological perspective, or simply not understanding it on its own terms. Yeah, I also remember 1994. I'm sorry about that. There was a lot of polling done that said the IFP would get 1% of the vote. I think just having some understanding of what those rural hinterlands looked like, the size of the population, I never believe it. I think about 10% was probably more or less correct. So, what that leads me to my comment about coalitions. The IFP promises to be faithful to the multi-party charter, and I think that, in some ways, its leadership is committed. But I think that there is also a part of itself. I don't know, call it a sort of cultural impulse that, that possibly feels more at home with with the ANC. I think it is very, very committed to its prospects in KwaZulu-Natal. I think that is something that, in some ways, is more important to itself than the national picture. And I don't know if it would be entirely be out of the question that they might prove receptive to an approach by a weakened but still powerful ANC, perhaps exchange for one or two national ministries, and control of KwaZulu-Natal in exchange for supporting the ANC. That so yeah, that is that's something that I don't think can be discounted. I'm I imagine that its leadership might well be able to justify that in terms of, well, it was it's better that it's with us than with the EFF, something something along those lines. Better that it's with a 5 or 6% party than with a 1% minnow that the ANC could steamroller. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that in 2004, remember the DA at that stage had this coalition for change with the IFP. And I remember senior people in the DA saying that didn't work out so well because while their relationship was very good with the IFP's national leadership, they could simply never make it work at provincial level. The IFP there simply felt that the interests were better served with cutting a deal with the ANC, with whom, not to put too fine a point in it, they, felt themselves to have more culturally and socially in common.
Maurice, do you have any final thoughts on this one? I
Yeah, I just
think,
have
yeah, I think we did miss out a bit here by not seeing the MK party's presence here, and this does suggest to me that the MK party might be being very strategic in where it chooses to fight. It's actually a way of making yourself look stronger than you really are by strategically choosing by-elections. You only compete in the ones that you're going to be willing to throw a lot of resources, time, and energy into, and then that makes you look like you're doing much better than you are because you just don't even stand in the ones in where you're going to get crushed. So maybe that was at play here. I want to hear your thoughts on that. And on, also, the crucial question is the IFP under major threat from the MK party? The polling right now doesn't really seem to suggest that, and we've seen the IFP lead a little bit of support to the ANC. Sorry, to the MK party in the one by-election. I think they've gone head to head with each other, but it's not been as much as the ANC has suffered. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I think with the MK party with a strategy of only standing in a certain by-elections, I think that strategy is sound. I mean, the DA does the same. The DA doesn't stand in every by-election across the country. It actually stands in, maybe 20% of the by-elections where it's actually got a chance of winning.
Right, I don't
Unlike
think the
the
DA
EFF,
stood in any of these, for example.
it did one in Mfuleni, but we can talk about that in a
Oh, the
sec.
one in Infinity, yeah.
But yeah, the EFF, for example, stands. I think it stood in every single by-election since. It's maybe missed one or two, and there've been about 200 by-elections. But then sometimes they look a bit foolish. There's been at least one by-election I can think of where they got 0 votes. So, and people can make hay of that and make hay about that on social media. And you got to ask yourself, is it a good use of your resources to go into an area where apparently it was an area in Middelburg, with full of golf estates, so not really EFF's kind of.
Yeah, it was a DA stronghold.
Exactly. So you go and you spend all this money on posters and whatever, and then you just end up looking kind of foolish. So, yeah, I think the IFP or the MK does probably pose a bit of a threat to the IFP. I think ANC, MK, and IFP are all going to be, and the EFF to a degree, are all going to be fishing in the same pond. But as a threat to the broader MPC, I don't really think the MK is. I think out of the parties in the MPC, the only kind of party where there will be an overlap with some people who might consider voting MK is the IFP. So, people who think of voting for the DA, they're probably not going to vote MK and vice versa. And just on the Coalition for Change in 2004, which Terence mentioned, I think things are a little bit different now, just from the point of view that in 2004, the ANC was at its zenith and the IFP was a declining force, and the DA also wasn't as strong as it is now. In 2004, the DA wasn't governing the Western Cape. It is governing the Western Cape now. It's a 20% party. In 2004, it was only a 12% party, or whatever it was. The IFP was on a was declining. As I said, the ANC would go on to get 70% in the 2004 election. So the environment was a little bit different. But I think I'm sure these kind of issues, personal animosities between maybe people in the DA and IFP still exist. And then just finally, just quickly, there were also three other by-elections, one in Mfuleni, like I mentioned, one in Moretele in Northwest, and one in Umshwati, which is also in KwaZulu-Natal. And just the point of those is that the ANC did all right in all of them. In Moretele, its vote actually went up from about 60-odd% to over 70. I mean, its only challenger was the EFF. But outside of KwaZulu-Natal, outside of the most of the Western Cape, and outside of most of the metros, the ANC is actually still doing pretty well. Obviously, there have been by-elections in rural South Africa where it's done fairly poorly. But most of the other by-elections, the ANC is still pretty solid. It's still getting 70, 80, 90% in some areas. And that's why I think the ANC being still very close to 50% is not impossible. And even, I mean, this Umshwati by-election that was also on Wednesday, that was also in KwaZulu-Natal. And the ANC got a 70-odd percent in that by-election there. And the IFP was also standing there. The IFP saw its vote go up a little bit, about only from 18 to 21% or so. So, even in the KwaZulu-Natal, the story of ANC decline is a little bit more nuanced than the ANC just completely falling apart.
Okay, let us move on to our next topic. And this is changes to South Africa's legislation regarding electricity. Now, this, I think, was promised by President Ramaphosa in his very first State of the Nation address. And here he talked about, you know, separating Eskom into various pieces, one of them being a transmission company, which would then allow equal access to the grid for all companies in the system. And this has been a crucial step needed to privatize the system, because currently Eskom is the monopoly on transmission, and it has basically full control of who can supply power in. And this has been one of the reasons that Eskom has been the kind of the bottleneck of electricity generation in South Africa. So it's hoped that by breaking off the transmission grid, that this will create a much more viable, vibrant market of electricity in the country. Well, that was promised by Ramaphosa, I think, back in, what, 2018 or 2017, somewhere around there. It's only now passing through the National Assembly, through Parliament, which is quite the delay. And there have been all sorts of very kind of mysterious hiccups with regards to this, as to why it has taken so long. I mean, André de Ruyter, when he was still the CEO of Eskom, said that he had already pretty quickly signed all the documentation and Eskom had done all the legwork, but that the energy regulator was dragging its feet on approving this. Anyway, it's finally going through. Energy expert is often quoted in the media, Chris Yaland, says that this is very important to the restructuring of electricity in South Africa, and that this is an important first step on to making the market more decentralized and vibrant. Maurice, let me start with you. I think this is good news. Obviously, the implementation of such a thing is going to be very important. It's not entirely through the legislative process yet. President still needs to sign it, still needs to go through the National Council of Provinces, and that can hold it up for another God knows how long. So I guess my question is twofold. One, how big of a improvement do you think this is? And two, why has it taken so long?
Yeah, I think it's not an area I'm really too well versed in, but from what I've read, it seems it's a really good thing for the electricity market and for South Africa as a whole. It's really going to bring in a lot of extra capacity to the grid, from what I can tell. And I think it's probably taken so long. Firstly, just, I mean, the legislative process, I think, unless it's something that ANC really wants to pass, can sometimes be held up in Parliament for ages. And it's also, I mean, this comes down to not only ANC inefficiency, but also ANC's ideology, which is very reluctant to let go of control of anything. You know, this is from SAA or Eskom or whatever the case is. And I think this is one of the cases where the hand was forced to a large degree. Apparently, the DA brought very similar legislation, or proposed very similar legislation 5 or 6 years ago, but the ANC turned it down because apparently the ANC only ever backed legislation that they themselves have developed. So, but yeah, I mean, if this is going to improve the electricity market, then I think it's definitely something we obviously need to support and be happy about. And, you know, maybe there is light at the end of the load shedding tunnel, but I still think maybe it's a train headlight rather than actually sunlight, but we'll see.
Terence, what do you make of this?
You know, this essentially like opens the gate for larger investments, and this must be seen with the allowance that firms could generate more than, I think it was, the one kilowatt, or, you know, whatever the derisory number was. I go back to, but I do think that comment made by Ricardo Hausmann needs to be borne in mind. There's no country that has had South Africa's type of electricity problem, which has allowed it to drag on for so long. And his explanation was that there's simply no political incentives in South Africa to actually deal with this. So, yeah, you know, if there's an ideological question, it can simply just circle the toilet bowl forever. You know, there's a. I think if everybody looks, reads my column on Monday, I talk about the relationship between government and business. You know, there have been resources that business is willing to make available. Government simply hasn't wanted them, or has refused them, or has, you know, snipped on the edges parsimoniously because we have to have this mighty developmental state, which is a creature more of the government's imagination than anything else. So good news. We have to wait and see how this plays out.
Any final thoughts, Marius?
No, but I mean, maybe it's on the green shoots we need. We'll have to see.
Indeed. Okay. Last story here. There is currently a deal out of an American sports company which is looking at investing in the Springboks, buying a 20% stake and basically putting in a whole bunch of money into the Springboks branding. This has, however, very deeply upset Sports, Arts and Culture Minister Zizu Kodwa, who says that, the headline on this story was, rugby can't be owned by Americans, or the national team can't be owned by Americans. So the deal hasn't gone through yet, but the minister was very upset. He said, I asked one of the vice presidents, and even before I got an answer, I made it clear that the national team can't be owned by Americans. I am aware that there are conversations ongoing with regard to the equity deal, but I haven't been briefed. Whatever conversations that are taking place about the equity deal, personal and individual interests must be removed. The conversations must be about the development of the game, and the manner of the headlines has made me very unhappy. He also went on to say that he thought the discussions were not handled in a manner he wanted. Marius, I don't really see what the minister is getting so upset about here.
But from what I mean, it's not like Americans are going to come buy the Springboks. It's not like suddenly Siya Kolisi is going to be, have to go play in the NFL or something like that. From what I understand, this company is just taking, they're going to be involved in the commercial side of the Springboks. So just the merchandise and marketing and getting TV rights and all that kind of thing. And doesn't seem like there's probably going to be an organization that's pretty, experienced in this kind of thing. So we'll probably see Springboks making a bit more money. And the more money Springboks makes, the more money can go to SAFU and rugby development and, getting even more kids playing rugby, which, I wouldn't be surprised now if we had to look at the numbers, if rugby isn't maybe starting to overtake soccer as the most popular sport in South Africa, just from the number of people supporting Springboks now. And I mean, this is just obviously a very small data point and it's coming from my own lived experience. But the other day I was somewhere and I saw a young black kid, he was maybe, 12 or 13, and he was walking down the road with a rugby ball, instead of a soccer ball. And I don't think that's something you wouldn't really have seen 5 or 6 years ago. So I think rugby is definitely starting to overtake soccer as maybe the most popular sport in South Africa. And shouldn't be surprising. I mean, Bafana didn't do too badly in the last AFCON. But apart from that, they've been pretty useless the last 15 or 20 years, unlike the Springboks. But yeah, I mean, this also just seems Zizi Kodwa is just a way to try to get, his name into the headlines again. And I'm not sure why.
Terence, your thoughts?
Well, as far as Zizi Kodwa and headlines goes, isn't Zondo Commission a word frequently associated with that, just out of interest?
The ANC doesn't seem to think so because they're putting him pretty high on the parliamentary list, so he'll be back in Parliament.
Well, this is the standard of probity you've come to expect from the ANC. I think this is perhaps speaks to a lack of understanding of what professionalized sport means. You may find it distasteful, whatever, but there's a lot of money associated with that, and Springboks are one of the big global brands. I imagine those, investors, wherever they are in Fort Worth or, Savannah.
I think this is a Seattle-based company.
Seattle, right. Apparently, good coffee, bad weather. Autonomous zones. Point is that I wonder whether these guys are actually, like manic rugby fans that, want to control, want to put little American flags on the rugby jerseys, or whether, they think that this is an opportunity to make money. As I say, maybe we think that's completely dreadful, but there it is. I seem to remember, 15 years ago, it was all hands on deck to make sure we got colonized by the Swiss from FIFA. And you had all these street traders hoping they're going to make a killing, but being policed about selling, counterfeit goods and things like that. It's the sort of way of the world. Maybe there's an upside to it. Maybe actually having an American connection means that we start to get South African rugby team gets increased exposure that side. America's not a huge rugby rugby playing country, but there is some interest in it. In fact, fun fact for everyone: there's a little scene in that music series Glee, where a guy tries to hit on one of the main characters, and he introduces himself as head of the Lima High rugby team. Just so you know.
So it was actually quite interesting when I was in the US a couple of years ago. I was speaking to an American football player, and he said that amongst American football players is actually sort of a growing appreciation for rugby, even though they're still committed most of the time to American football as very much their main sport. That's what they want to do. Quite a lot of them will play rugby sometimes as a way of training or practicing slightly different skills and changing things up a little bit, which I found quite interesting. So I do think the potential for rugby to become quite a big thing is certainly sitting there in the US. Remains to be seen. Morris, any final thoughts?
The 2031 Rugby World Cup is going to be held in the US, so I
Ooh.
think that could be quite a boost to them. We know the 1994 World Cup, Football World Cup, was in the US, and there was a lot of support for it then. And the US is now not a bad soccer team in the men's game, in the women's game. It's one of the, I think, is the best team in the world in the women's game. So yeah, we'll have to see what happens, and I'm sure it'll be a very big boost for rugby. I mean, we all know America's the richest country in the world, and it's got 350 million people, or whatever it is. So if rugby can get in there, that's a very big boost for the sport. And yeah, it's and hopefully, just as long as they never get so bad in the Springboks, then I think we can all be happy.
If I could just make a small personal observation there myself, when I lived in Taiwan, you'd find expats would kind of congregate together, and there'd be a lot of watching of big sporting events. You'd find Americans and Canadians watching rugby from time to time, and South Africans would join American colleagues to watch American football. My brother had a friend who had actually played sort of quite serious college level football, and he always used to marvel at rugby, and he said that the skills you need in rugby actually are in excess of what you need for American football. And I remember my late brother saying that there have been rugby players who've transitioned into American football. Norse Werther did that for a while, but nobody has actually done it the other way. So, maybe there's something that we can teach our American friends.
Indeed. All right. I think that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much, everyone. We hope that you found the show interesting, and we will see you tomorrow. Or sorry, not tomorrow. It's Friday. My mind is slow today. Next week on the Daily Friend Show. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.